I'm rather pleased the number of folks that turned out. When I saw where Michael and Steve Weaver had placed me in the order of events, I asked Michael just what I'd ever done to him to deserve such a spot. Then he assured me that I'm last, not because I'm least, though you may discover that you have other opinions of that, but that he's done this all chronologically, so I'm where it makes sense that my guy is one of the last in the time period that's being discussed this week. I also have to admit up front, as Jeff did yesterday with his paper, that when I agreed with Michael Haken to take this challenge on, I had never heard of my guy. Being an Edwards guy and American Puritans, I was well familiar with Baptists because it's my minor, but it was one of these issues of Thomas who? Little Google search, little Amazon. I quickly discovered that most other people have the same response when you mention Thomas Hardcastle. So hopefully, per Ron's prayer request, we will quadruple the number of people who have ever heard of Thomas Hardcastle this afternoon. But I think it's a fitting topic, as I looked at the discussion, when Michael Haken asked me, he said, pick a guy, and I looked down the list of guys I'd never heard of before, as he got more and more obscure, trying to fit in some of us, his students at the time. I thought, prison epistles, that's interesting. You know, Paul's written a few, Bunyan's written a few, Bonhoeffer and so forth. So I thought, I can do that. What was fascinating is I've read his 22 letters, is just how much meat is really in these 22 letters from prison. So that's what I want to talk about this afternoon then, is really what he's trying to teach, or albeit preach, through his letters from the prison. So I'll begin there with an opening quote, the very first lines of his first letter from jail. The Lord has been pleased to permit the wrath of the adversary to break out so far upon us as to separate us and shut me up in prison again and out of the public assembly for a season. Thus, divine pleasure thinks fit to deal with us. Though you cannot see my face nor hear my voice, yet I can write epistles to you, which being read among you, may through the blessing of God be a means to encourage, instruct, and establish you. And thus begins Thomas Hardcastle's first prison epistle to the Baptist Church in Broadmead. 21 additional letters were to follow this one, and through the ministry of his pen, Hardcastle sought to help his congregation make sense of the times in which they lived, times which actually rendered them enemies of king and country, not to mention pastorless. More than that, however, Hardcastle longed for them to be able to see the gospel sense of their situation, to see their present persecution in light of the gospel. So today, few Baptists know of Thomas Hardcastle. Outside of this gathering here of austere scholars, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find many people who've heard of him. Even fewer works, oddly enough, on Baptist history take notice of this suffering servant. History has, as it were, confined him to a bygone era. And although he is little known, he still has much to say to us. And while his prison epistles survey the vast landscape of Christian piety, the gospel was his primary concern in these letters. The gospel, he wrote, explains and it validates Christian suffering. And thus, Hardcastle's letters make gospel sense of an ageless question, why do bad things happen to good people? So a little historical background, much of which we've already heard in various other discussions this week, but let me lay it down for you quickly. Suffering was nothing new to Hardcastle and the church meeting in Broadmead when the heavy hand of the law came down upon them in 1675. The congregation and their pastor had long histories of persecution and perseverance, and in God's providence, he had prepared his people for such a time as this. So first, as the church's background as they saw the events as they transpired. The Church of Christ, meeting in Broadmead, began as an independent congregation in 1640, just before those heady years of the English Civil War, the Protectorate, and the high hopes of a thoroughgoing Reformation that had informed that initial gathering at Westminster. Located in a commercial area of Bristol, the church was populated, as Brackney labels him, I think, while I disagree with much Brackney has to say, I thought his summary was a good statement, of well-to-do, socially informed persons who were leaders in the religious community. And the church would eventually found that well-known Bristol Academy in the year after Hardcastle's death to forward their Baptistic faith even further. And given that influence then in the evangelical world of that 17th century in England, it is little wonder that they became the target of ecclesiastical opposition. Not long after calling Hardcastle to be their pastor, according to the church minutes and records, the church entered its eighth season of persecution in 1674. And the confluence of politics and religion ultimately conspired against them. with the appointment of a new bishop, one Guy Carleton, one that they refer to as the Philistine among them, a new mayor, Ralph Olive, who entertained hopes of political advancement and a drinking problem, and a new civil attorney, John Hellyer, the church had what they called three pestilent adversaries who were seeking to end their independence and to bring them back into the Anglican fold. When the inhabitants of the land saw a fiery meteor in the sky on the night of February 6, 1675, they knew that the stars had been aligned against them. And thus, with the arrival of Hellyer and the constabulary on February 14th, there was little surprise when the full weight of the Clarendon Code was finally brought to bear against them. And there, Thomas Hardcastle was dragged from their midst and thrown into the Newgate jail. Hardcastle, though, also brings a perspective to all this. Hardcastle's arrest was not his first legal encounter with the authorities either. He had been arrested five times during his previous pastorate. In fact, he was serving a prison sentence when the church in Broadmead called him to be their pastor. Now, how many churches would do that today? The church Hardcastle was serving at the time was the very same church that had been pastored by Henry Jacob, John Lathrop, and Henry Jesse. And that church refused to give him release to go to the church in Broadmead. They refused to release him from duty to them. And in fact, they did so until the day he died, at which point they finally, I guess, admitted defeat and had said that he could move on. Upon us from his release from prison, however, he made the move on to the influential church in Broadmead. And there, Hardcastle was licensed to preach in 1671-72 by Charles II's government as one, as they called it, of the persuasion commonly called baptized. Hardcastle remained a legal pastor only so long as the king honored his declaration of indulgence from 1672. However, Charles's tolerance ended abruptly in 1674-75, whereupon the Conventicle Act, wherein they weren't allowed to have groups of more than five gathered for unauthorized religious gatherings, was enforced with a vengeance, and the unleashing of religious bounty hunters who sought out illicit congregations. As an aside, for those of you not real familiar with the area, this idea, the Conventicle Act and the five, really hamstrung them. How could they meet? And very often what they would do was they would meet in adjoining buildings, very often cutting a hole in the wall or knocking down the doors and hanging a curtain. So if the police showed up in one place, there was a group of less than five. Or if they showed up in the other place, there was a group of less than five. And on occasion, what they would do is the preacher would be behind a curtain with a small group of people. So if the constabulary showed up in his place, he would quickly sit down and they would be unable to decide who was preaching the service. Unfortunately for one of Hardcastle's peers, when they showed up, they pulled down the curtain between the two rooms before the preacher had a chance to sit down, and they quickly discovered who was in fact the preacher of the hour, and he was arrested. These bounty hunters, in fact, was what led them to Hardcastle and the church at Broadmead there. Such an informant led the authorities of Bristol to the gathering where Hardcastle and his congregation were conducting their weekly worship service. Hardcastle was arrested, along with several other dissenting pastors that day, in February of 1674-75. After serving 6 months in jail, where he observed the death of another pastor, Mr. Thompson, Hardcastle was released on August 6th. When he was released, he was basically free for less than a week. He was arrested again, taken back to jail for 2 days, arrested again, and then thereupon comes the letters we're looking at this afternoon. So he's released on August 6th to enjoy that 1 week of freedom before being arrested on the same charges and sentenced to another 6 months in Newgate. For those of you not familiar with Newgate, the original jail was destroyed by the Great London Fire. Newgate was the new prison. It was the one everybody thought was the best prison available. Apparently it was so bad, though, that when people in London walked down the street near the prison, the stench from human waste was so bad it would make people sick on the street. And it is suggested that Hardcastle, when he died at a young age, probably was a result of his time in prison, from which he never really recovered. And it is during this second consecutive term, then, that Hardcastle sought to minister to his congregation via these prison epistles, for as he believed, quote, "my imprisonment preaches louder than I ever did." So let's talk then a little bit about the gospel preaching then of persecution, according to Thomas Hardcastle. Thomas Hardcastle was thoroughly convinced that persecution served a purpose. And as he began his first epistle to the Broadmead brethren, he counseled them, quote, "to realize the gospel and to consider upon what terms we took up profession and what the cross of Christ means. persecution, Hardcastle would say, brings the reality of the gospel and all that it entails to the fore. In the end, however, Hardcastle's letters were meant to be more than simply a healing balm. They were a Christian challenge, a call to action, sermons with strong applications. In these letters, he encouraged his church not only to endure the trials in light of the gospel, but to do so for the sake of the gospel. They should, Hardcastle explained, respond to their present difficulties with gospel love, love for God, love for each other, and love for their enemy. In doing so, he told them, you fulfill the gospel of Christ. Thus, they were not to see their suffering as senseless but purposeful. They were suffering, he said, for the furtherance of the gospel. And breaking down those three areas then that he said gospel love is portrayed and furthered. First of all, then, he encouraged them to love your heavenly Father more. According to Hardcastle's theology, suffering serves to bring the Christian ever closer to his God. Those who struggled spiritually during seasons of suffering did so because their focus was set upon the wrong thing. They concentrate, he worried, on the badness of men rather than the goodness of God. And therefore, his prison epistles are seasoned with invaluable insights into the work of God and the way in which persecution serves God's gospel ends by bringing fallen men to the throne of their merciful Father. And like Job millennia before, Hardcastle understood that his life's course was determined by God. Blessings and cursings, prosperity and persecution, he believed, come as determined by the will of God. The sharp providence, he said, of God, felt in the sting of suffering, can also be seen as the good providence. And he interchanges those terms very often as he tries to interpret the situation. But blessing of all blessings, their pastor reminded them, the suffering permitted by God is also limited by God. That God is in hand all things here in the situation. And as he says, and I quote, not a tongue nor hand could move if the Lord did not suffer it. Thus, God chides and God provides those whom he loves through divine providence. Certainly, Hardcastle felt, the church was suffering under the stern hand of God in their present situation. God was angry with them, he wrote them. And one reason for God's rebuke that he returned to throughout these letters was the ineffectual worship of the people. Their worship, he had bemoaned in his very last letter even, was unbiblical, driven by human invention and overly concerned about the fear or flattery of men. They had, in fact, become man-centered and raised the ire of their jealous God. And as Hardcastle wrote them, for that they suffered. And this is a theme, just as an aside note here, that he returns to often. If you have interest in early Baptist understandings as a regulative principle, it's throughout these letters. Constantly he's reminding them, your worship is weak, your worship is pathetic. He talks about some of the other congregations that are being persecuted, not by name, but points out again that they're going through the motions. He talks about forms, he talks about dress. So worship, it seems to be an issue that he believes is the root of what is going on there in that time period. Yet, returning to our idea here, God, being a God of grace, does not pour forth his wrath without purpose. Through personal, private, and public trials and afflictions, Hardcastle said, God humbles the soul and leads it back to himself and Christ, as he said, the true ark of salvation. And those who so respond, God will surely save, he promised them. It is God's faithfulness, he counseled, to which they should look as the beacon of their hope, not their own. For as he reminded them, God saves, and he saves them in these five ways. He says that he saves you notwithstanding your own unworthiness, imperfections, backslidings, and unfitness for mercy. Two, God saves notwithstanding our fears, our faintings, our despondencies, our unbelief, and positive conclusions against ourselves, our hopes, and the return of mercy. Three, he says, God saves notwithstanding all the improbabilities and growing oppositions and obstructions that seem to lie in the way of their peace and deliverance. He says God saves, number four, notwithstanding the power, prevalency, expectations, and interests and insultings of the enemy. And five, God saves, notwithstanding many tokens and testimonies of his own displeasure and indignation against them, and a kind of resolution not to show mercy to them anymore. Thus, through suffering, God surely draws the weak and the wayward back to himself, depending wholly upon God, that they might know and love him in ever new ways. Suffering then becomes a renewed application of the gospel in the life of the church and the believer. As Hardcastle contended, persecution serves to get the love out of, or get the world, love of the world out of God's people and the love of God back into them. And through trial and tribulation, God teaches his people that they ought to be willing to part with everything, he said, rather than part with him, his name, profession, word, or worship. In suffering, in other words, God teaches his people to love him all the more. He says that is the root of the gospel. He also goes on and says, too, though, that the gospel is also promoted and furthered in suffering, and that it also teaches us to love our fellow members and brethren more. Suffering, he continues, and persecution serve to propagate the gospel in another way. According to Hardcastle, believers fulfill the gospel when they love one another. And to that end, he called them to bear the weight of their situation gladly for the benefit of the other believers. In addition to stagnant worship, Hardcastle proposed to his readers, the cause for their present problems also arose from their failing to love one another in the past. Sounds like many of our churches today. And as he says, while we enjoy days and months and years of plenty, peace, prosperity, and liberty, we had not a sense, sympathy, fellow feeling of the miseries, distractions, distresses, persecutions that were upon many in several places of the nation. They had, in our language, dropped the ball. Other people had suffered before them, and they had apparently done not enough to help. Worse yet, he continues, they had fallen prey to the sins of jealousy, prejudice, and gossip. And for these reasons, he said, they should not be surprised by the arrival of their own difficulties. There is hope, however. God can turn evil for good. Benefit and advantage, he says, can be had when those who are now bearing the weight of persecution stand and patiently suffer in the good ways of God rather than decline and draw back. God was using their suffering, Hardcastle argued, not to punish the people, but to correct them, to open their eyes to needs previously overlooked. Suffering and the faith it builds makes the soul very generous, he wrote, willing and desirous to do good to all, would have every soul saved and converted and healed, and every back clothed and belly filled, and wishes that it could but speak or do that which might attain all these ends. End quote. In the midst of their problems, they could see and they could sympathize with a lot of others. In doing so, Hardcastle hoped that they would minister to them in newfound love. Again, quoting from Hardcastle, he says, you serve thousands of others by this sacrifice and resignation of yours. He believed and he preached in his letters that persecution graciously grants God's people or forces them to evaluate their commitment to their faith, to awaken them from spiritual slumber, and to share the love of Christ with each other. Doing so, he argued, believers minister to one another, even in the absence of the minister. Thus, suffering becomes a means of good rather than evil, as God's people become a blessing to those around them. And to that end, he exhorted them, Christians must take full advantage of seasons of distress. They must, as he said, take up their cross presently, because they have no idea how many thousands may be encouraged by the grace with which they suffer. And he adds in this section of the letter quite a bit of encouragement or admonition to not only suffer willingly for the sake of others, but in fact not to want to rush the suffering. He in fact encourages them to relish it while they have it, which would be so foreign to modern ears. But what his encouragement is that they don't know what God is using it for. And if their desire is to rush through it, they may in fact be circumventing God's blessings for others. So he says you need to enjoy, if we can use that term, the problems you're encountering today, because in doing so, by suffering them gladly, by taking advantage of it, if you will, he says you are in fact blessing others, many of whom you will never meet or know. So rather than counseling them to rush through it, to do their best to get out of the situation, he in fact paints it in a very positive light and suggests to them that really, ultimately, the suffering is not about them, but it's about those who are around them watching them. So he says, you serve thousands of others in this way as they take up the cross presently. Hardcastle also, though, did not merely tell his people how they should respond to the evil that had befallen them. From the confines of Newgate, he lived the gospel before them and for them. He says, I think and am persuaded my second imprisonment will be a greater advantage to you and to the gospel than the first. And to that, he believed, he had been called, as he adds in later in another letter. He says, watchmen must endure hardship. They must meet with the waters of affliction and stand in them and see to the safety of the whole with the hazard of themselves. And of course, there he's talking about as the Israelites crossed the Jordan behind Joshua and the priests. He points to them to look to the priests who are holding the heavy Ark of the Covenant as being in a symbol, if you will, of what now present-day ministers must face in their persecutions. And each letter that Hardcastle wrote contained similar words of biblical wisdom and personal example. Hardcastle could have done no less, for he was, in his mind, like the Apostle Paul, and these are Hardcastle's words here, a prisoner for Christ's sake, and I hope for yours and the gospel's advantage. And therefore, the church in Broadmead, like their pastor, must see their suffering as a work of and a work for God, and they must persevere accordingly. He encourages them, be not weary of well-doing and well-suffering. Sometimes, indeed, he says, a saint of God may be weary in his work, but he is never weary of his work. And so long as they remain faithful to the task, they could rejoice with Hardcastle in their sufferings that the gospel had not lost, but in fact had gotten ground by our sufferings. The gospel spreads, he wanted them to see, as God's people share his love through theirs. And then the third component of his gospel message of suffering is the idea that he encourages them also then to love your adversaries more. Hardcastle's admonition to love God in the midst of persecution may have been expected. His exhortation to love one another was probably unsurprising to them. His final directive, however, surely would have shocked the sensibilities of some of his parishioners. They must remember, he told them, to love their enemies, the very source of their problems. To that they had been called, and in doing so, they would in fact fulfill the gospel. So he writes to them, let us walk answerably to our profession, he begged them. Moreover, he continued, they must take advantage of the current situation while they could, as I hinted earlier. God had granted them a season of service, he said, wherein they might preach the gospel to their accusers by the way in which they persevered. See, he didn't want them just to suffer quietly. He wanted them to suffer with grace, so as in essence to heap burning coals on their enemies' heads by their kindness as they served them in this way. He says, suffering leaves a testimony in their conscience, when shrinking might harden them in their wickedness and draw out their rage all the more. They were to bear the weight of their tribulation gladly, proving the strength of their faith and displaying the love of Christ, knowing that actions speak louder than words. They were, in short, to live the gospel, even if it meant death. And not only should persecuted believers suffer gladly as an opportunity to set a Christian example, he wrote them, they must take a personal interest, seeing the enemy as Christ does, in light of the gospel. In this light, the enemy was, Hardcastle explained, not to be loathed, but in fact they were to be pitied. In a lengthy quote here from him, he says, faith sets before the soul the persecutors as a company of dying men, poor creatures that in a very few days will have their bodies in the grave and their souls in everlasting flames, if the case be not altered with them. The vengeance of God hanging over their heads, ready to bury them in eternal torments every moment. Oh, poor wretches, miserable souls, pity them, pity them. Their disturbing you will quickly be over, but the wrath of God will forevermore torment them. In essence, he was telling him, the future was far worse for the persecutor than it was the present for the persecuted. And therefore, if they truly loved their enemy as they should, they must not only pity them, but they also must take a personal interest in their eternal destiny. And thus he encourages them to pray for your enemies. Pray not that God would lessen the persecution, but that God would save their souls, which would in the end also result in good times for the saints. The suffering saints, he would argue, were to pray for the salvation of the enemy, asking that God would add the adversaries to their own numbers. He also adds to these things, persecuting times have been converting times. He argued that history is replete with examples of people who came to faith not in the best of times, but in the worst of times. In due time, he told them, you will find that many will date their spiritual birth, their love to the things of God, their confirmation in the truths of God, from such a year, the first year that such a bishop came to town, and such a man being governor of the city that year. And as they remained faithful to the gospel in the face of their trials, when they loved God, when they loved each other, and they loved their enemies, the year 1675 could be such a time. And as he adds, this has been a year of the right hand of the Most High, and it ought to be ever remembered and never forgotten. Then by way of conclusion, then, trying to bring all this together in a short little sentence or two, Hardcastle, locked away in that infamous jail at Newgate, wrote loving letters to his church. They had been left behind and without a pastor, and he continued to pastor them from there. He wrote, he said in his very first letter, to encourage, to instruct, and to establish them. In these 22 letters that spread over these 6 months, he writes encouragements to pray. In fact, there's quite a bit of language and theology on how to pray and why. He also instructs them in these letters about the necessity for theocentric worship. A common theme he returns to often. He also sought to establish their faith by telling them of the nature and exercise of true faith. And for someone interested in pursuing these letters further, of the 22 letters, letters number 10 through 21 all include nothing but teaching on faith. What is faith? How to recognize your faith? How to build your faith? What God is doing to your faith in these times? Ultimately, however, the gospel was Hardcastle's greatest concern, and he desired to help the church in Broadmead make gospel sense of their situation. And seen in the light of the gospel, he believed, suffering does make sense. They would see their suffering with more joy than trouble, he wrote, just as the pastor did, because the Lord gets honor, the gospel advantage, and, he promises, the Lord is preparing for you an exceeding great reward. Thus, as Hardcastle professed in his last letter from prison, he wrote these letters that we may know our duty and be enabled to keep close to it, to the glory of his name, and here's what he associated with the glory of his name, to the glory of his name, that is, the propagation of the gospel. The letters are about the gospel, and suffering is for that end.